And with a look at the backcountry, on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, Evelyn Lees. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Leslie. Well, we have issued an avalanche warning because as this cold front comes through in the next few hours, it's, you know, the snow rates are going to increase and the winds are going to pick up, and then we're expecting the avalanche danger to rise to high. It's going to be so tricky out there because there may not be widespread natural avalanches, but any slope that hasn't already slid is kind of going to be hanging in balance, just need a trigger such as a person, and then you'd end up with a large dangerous avalanche. We've been talking for weeks about the shallow, faceted, sugary snow, and that's the exact kind of weak layer where you're going to be able to trigger a slide from below or from adjacent slopes. So it's then that's also what makes it trickier out there is people may be on a summer trail and not realize that they could trigger a slide coming down on them. So we do not recommend backcountry travel in avalanche terrain today, and that includes, you know, gullies, steep road cuts, and like train tracks, like creek beds and things. And if people are kind of confused with what I'm saying, then they're the exact people who shouldn't go into the backcountry today. We've got the, you know, the bigger new snow slab danger up high, and then with all that rain, there's a chance for wet loose sloughs and wet slabs at the lower elevations. So, again, a high avalanche danger today, and backcountry travel in avalanche terrain is not recommended.
Okay. Evelyn, thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
8:19. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour here on KPCW, where the Park City Board of Education met yesterday in a work session diving into next year's budget as well as what's next for the master planning process. In the studio, I have School Board President Andrew Kaplan along with the Associate Superintendent of Wellness, Ben Belknap. Good morning to both of you.
Morning, Leslie. Morning.
So I'll let you guys kind of jump in when you kind of maybe know more than the other, or at least have some more expertise. So maybe start with you, Andrew, in terms of the budget. What is our projection for adding new hires for next year and then the following 3 to 4 years out?
Yeah, so we're taking a slightly different approach this year. As you know, we hired quite a few people last year, and included in last year's budget was a projection for this year to add additional headcount. And really what the conversation yesterday was taking a step back and saying, okay, we added a lot of people last year. We're probably going to add some over the next several years. But let's take a step back and let's reassess where those people are, how have they integrated, and can we reallocate some of our resources into other places to make them more efficient? And a lot of the conversation was, I would say, more of a philosophical one rather than a dollars and cents one. And was really led by Ben, Dr. Belknap, and Dr. Einhorn around MTSS, multi-tiered structures support or systems of support, and kind of the overall plan for district learning. And so I'll let Ben talk a little bit about that and how we can become a little bit more efficient with the people we have. So, you know, it's a long way of answering your question, which is we don't have a full proposal yet from administration in terms of how many new people we have. We do know that, you know, we have a need to raise taxes this year to pay for our staff wage increases from last year. So we know that already going in, and we knew that when we agreed to the new contracts this year. But beyond that, we're still going to, you know, have some pretty serious discussions. And I don't think that the asks are going to be as substantial as a percentage increase as they were last year.
And that's the $3.4 million line item that we see in the budget to pay for the hiring done for this school year.
To pay for the hiring done for this school year, but also more importantly, the larger percentage of that is to pay for the increases that we gave all of our staff, all of our teachers, our classified and our admin last year. And that was a conscious decision that we made to prioritize the wages of our employees. And we knew that going in, and that hasn't changed. So, you know, I don't see the same type of step-up increase. Obviously, a lot of that we knew about, and we put in a lot of new bodies last year. But we will be looking to, you know, I know that the administration would like us to do things like add some assistant principals in some of the schools that don't currently have them, things like that, which, you know, we'll be discussing. But the other main constraint that we have, Leslie, and it was brought up, is space. And we just don't have space for a ton of new people. We don't have room in our schools. We don't have, you know, we just closed all of our schools for enrollment because of the programs that we have and the lack of space. So it's going to be very difficult for us to add a ton of new people when we don't have a lot of seats for them. So that's another constraint that we have.
So, Ben, apparently we still have not hired all of the wellness staff that had been approved as of the current year budget. So where are we with that?
Well, at this point with the wellness staff, that's part of the discussion that we had yesterday was there's a hire, as far as the hiring cycle goes, the time to really find somebody is going to be around March when we can post it. So people are looking for positions for the new year. So that's one piece that we're looking at. For example, we currently have an opening to replace Jennifer Slade as our special education director. She left in early December. And we had opened that position to hire at mid-year, and we're still hoping to do so. Looking at the applicants that we have, though there are some strong applicants, to really get a broad pool, we're considering maybe pushing that back, for example, so we can hire for next year. In addition, though, we also want to be very mindful, as Andrew said, about hiring new people before we have the appropriate structure in place to utilize them most efficiently. As I've come onto this district, though I had a lot of these big grand plans I wanted to put into motion, I had to kind of put a hold on those to get this structure in place first so that we can facilitate those changes as necessary. And I think it would be a more efficient use of our resources to get the structure in place and then see where we need to fill those staff in.
Yeah, I guess there's some concern that many of the open positions are just for part-time and when people are looking for at least a full-time position. So what's the philosophy on that? I know it's a big money saver.
Yeah, well, I don't think the intention, maybe Todd, our business administrator, would disagree with me, but I don't think the intention was ever to do it for cost savings. I think it was, you know, every hiring manager looks at their needs and their headcount needs, and obviously, it's more cost efficient for every individual hiring manager to say, well, I need one person here, I need a half a person here, I need a quarter of a person here. The problem is that you don't get the efficiencies across, you know, your hiring. And as you pointed out, if you have, you know, instead of hiring perhaps four quarter time people, if you can find someone who can do two or three of those jobs, that would be better for everyone, right? It would be better for the district. It would be better for the employee. And that's one of the things that the administration is doing right now. And we talked about it a little bit, but HR and admin are looking at those part-time jobs and seeing if some of them can be done by the same people. Whether that's sharing them between buildings, whether it's sharing them between departments. You know, we're fortunate that we have a lot of very talented employees. And so we're trying to see, okay, can we fit, you know, can we give people more hours? And then that solves a lot of problems for us.
Right. We had heard from Ember on Monday, just though talking about, you know, I had asked her about one of the teachers' issues was a top-heavy administration. She came in, we saw some thinning there, and yet now she's just saying she doesn't have the staff she needs to run the programs that have been implemented. So how are we going to fill that need?
Well, there's always a balance, right? It's a seesaw. We don't want to have too many people, you know, doing admin jobs, but we also want to have enough where they're able to provide enough support for our educators, right, and for the people in our buildings. And so I think we went a little bit overboard in cutting positions and not giving the admin enough bandwidth. Last year, we did a lot as a board and as an admin team to try to rectify that and bring in people like Dr. Belknap to provide the bandwidth that we needed. And I think now we're kind of trying to take a step back and say, okay, where are we on that seesaw? Are we exactly in the right place, or do we need a few more people? I think at the school level, you know, as I mentioned before, there's a possibility for a need for some assistant principals to help the building principals out, and you know, especially at the elementary level. And if that, you know, is something that we collectively decide makes sense, then we'll do that. But you know, we clearly as an admin team and as a board have prioritized the teachers, making sure that they're paid. Prioritizing our resources there. Admin is obviously secondary, but in order to make sure that the teachers are happy and that they're able to do their jobs, we do need to provide that support. So we're looking at it as a group, and we're going to continue to look at it. And that's one of the most difficult things that we have to do as a district.
Yeah, I mean, and we've got lots of changes coming. Of course, we've got Ember Conley leaving, Kathleen Einhorn leaving, Tim McConnell leaving. We're going to need a new high school principal. I mean, plus what you're talking about. Where do we start first?
Well, you know, fortunately, Tim is with us for at least another year. Dr. Conley has also agreed to stay on through the end of this year, and then also into, as a consultant for several months after that to help transition to a new superintendent. I think what we're discussing is the timing for the replacement of Dr. Einhorn. We'd love her to stay on a little bit more, but. You know, I think that may be a position that the new superintendent will fill. And then, you know, again, the high school principal, that's kind of one of our keynote or keystone administrators. And, we're going to start looking at that as well right now. And they're all important. They're all important positions. Our high school has done extremely well under Mr. O'Connor. And, we were named number one in the state by USA Today, and we're a top ranked high school from US News and World Report, and a lot of that is obviously we can thank Mr. O'Connor, but a lot of it is also the teachers who are in the building and the educators who are there, and fortunately those folks are going to still be there, right, and continuing to do their job at an excellent level like they are. So the very good news that we have is that we live in a wonderful town, and this is a place that people want to move to. So I think we're not going to have a shortage of applicants for any of those positions.
Let's talk briefly a discussion about how the master planning process moves forward and how it will progress in light of all of these leadership changes. Again, I mean, we saw with a change in the board leadership kind of going back and doing the master planning process. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that when we get new administrative leadership, we're going to do the same thing all over again?
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, when we brought in Nick Salmon, who's our consultant who helped us do the initial assessment on master planning, it coincided with Dr. Conley announcing her plans to step down. And he was able to say, look, when this type of thing happens, which is, it does happen, that superintendents come and go, it's better to wait a little bit to do this process so that the new superintendent can be involved and can see what the community really wants and see firsthand, go to those meetings and see what people have to say. So, we discussed in our meeting yesterday timing and trying to give the admin some direction in terms of timing for master planning. And one of the proposals that came from Nick Salmon was to start the process late spring, summer, but really in earnest, kick it off in the fall in terms of community input and community involvement. And that's one of the things that we're considering as a board and as an admin team is to start it this fall, which would coincide with the new superintendent being in the seat so that we wouldn't have to repeat ourselves or do this again.
So that's a long way of saying we won't see a school bond for facilities on November's election.
I think that would be highly unlikely. What we've promised to the community is a promise that we continue to want to keep, which is we're going to do this as a community process, and we're going to do it correctly, and we're going to hear what people want for their facilities, and we're not going to tell them what we want or what we think. We will tell them, from a school's perspective, what we think the best way to educate the children are, obviously, and we do have the experts in that. But we also want to hear from the community, what do we want our graduates to look like? What do we want our programs to look like, all the way from elementary to high school? And that process just takes some time. And given that now we're going to have a new superintendent as well, I think it would probably be, sensible to have that type of timeline where we're starting the master planning process this summer, fall. And that would definitely mean that we wouldn't be bonding, this fall. That said, if we come up with some smaller projects, there's still a possibility that we would bond. There's also a possibility that we would do a capital tax levy to either start building a war chest or to pay for a smaller project, whatever that is. So there's all the options are on the table, and we're going to continue to look at it, but I don't see a massive bond hitting the ballot this fall.
And I guess that when you talk about, early on, when you said we don't have space, how long can we wait?
Well, we're doing all right right now. I mean, it's not ideal. We have kids in trailers, which no one ever likes, and it's never the ideal for a school district. But, you know, we have all of our kids. We're offering a ton of programs, more than any district in the state, and, you know, we continue to kind of add more programs and find space for them. And that's always the balancing act is trying to figure out how to get our great programs that you know, that our community desires into the building. So we're gonna do so deliberately and slowly, but you know, we're gonna continue to offer the excellent education that we're doing right now.
And then Ben, do you feel like you've got those cornerstones now in place to kind of move ahead on what you were hired to do?
I think we definitely have a good plan to move forward starting this next school year, and that's partially why we've had to be really strategic in our budget talk. With new administration coming in, we just need to have a good framework to get things pushed forward. So I had a great meeting just yesterday with some folks from the PC Reads organization here in town. And, you know, a lot of their concern was around the curriculum being taught to our kids in special ed or otherwise. Are they getting the best intervention, best support necessary for dyslexia, for example? This was a great conversation because we could hire more support right now for those teachers so those kids have more individualized service, et cetera. But we are moving more toward making sure we have a good curriculum director in place to make sure that that professional development curriculum is appropriately dispensed down through into the teachers so that the instruction is more effective. Similarly with mental health, same thing. We're hoping to add 2 new social workers, so we'll have a social worker in each school. And we need more community involvement, more community activities. I've worked very closely with Mary Krista Smith from Communities That Care and Aaron Newman. They are wonderful resources, and we're looking to really create a more robust wraparound model for our students next year.
Okay, guys, I need to leave it there. Thanks for your
great
time.
Thanks, Leslie.
Well, the Park City Council meeting and work session tomorrow starting at 2:45 in the City Council chambers. In the studio with a rundown of the agenda, Assistant City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
At 2:45, the council begins the interviewing process for 15 applicants for City Council. Will everybody be getting asked the same questions?
They will. They will indeed. So we had 15 applicants. I think the City Council and staff did a great job of putting the word out to the community. And the first few days, we only had a couple applicants, and we were a little worried. And by the end of the deadline, we had a total of 15, which just shows a wonderful level of interest in joining our City Council. And I think that we're very excited about the interview process. So we'll do half of the group this Thursday evening, and then we'll do the rest of the group on the 16th.
Yeah,
and ultimately hope to have a decision on the 23rd.
Yeah, I'm wondering about the fairness of this process. So since they're all open to the public, it means the applicants that don't get interviewed until next week can kind of watch and form their answers based on what they hear today, tomorrow.
No, that's fair. And they, the mayor and City Council have given the applicants some idea of the questions that they might get asked, as well as some sort of the qualifications and qualities that they're looking for in the individual that they would appoint to Mayor Bierman's council seat. So although they are open to the public, I would imagine, out of respect for the applicants, that most folks will tend to wait in the hall. I assume that the press will be there and some staff. But when we typically interview for boards and commissions, people, you know, will give people the benefit of the doubt and give them a little bit of privacy during their interview.
Okay, 5:20, an update, a quick update on the parking technology launch. Of course, we have been reporting on the late night vandalism. 2 arrests apparently have made. So is that vandalism continuing, or do you think just an isolated event when it first was implemented?
We hope it's an isolated event, and it's obviously sort of front and center with the changes, and we're paying extra special attention to it. And because we have these new kind of mast arm and booms that are on the front of the parking lots, when they get damaged, it's a lot more noticeable to the community. I mean, we have graffiti all over the community and damage, and we go to great lengths to make sure we clean it up. And we have wonderful sort of internal controls about 24 hours to clean up graffiti and fix a broken sign. But when it's something that's impeding maybe entry or exit to the garage, it's obviously very, very noticeable. That being said, though, we hope some of this is just growing pains. Our police and parking officers have been doing yeoman's work day in and day out, and we just think that this is sort of the growing pains of a new system, and we hope to overcome that.
Staff has received reports from people frustrated with their tickets not working on exit and requiring support, causing lines to back up in the garage. just why not just keep the gates open and, you know, until 5 o'clock when we start charging for parking?
Well, one of our approaches here is to really get a better systematic count and data of who is coming in and out of these garages, how often they're being used, what the volume is, and then using that information to inform our pricing. The City Council has made great efforts for this transportation demand management system, which is more efficiently managing the input and output of automobiles in our city. And so we need to be able to count and collect that information. And we think the best way to do that is to have control over these entry points and be able to systematically know how many cars are in our lots at how many times. And then we want to be responsive with our pricing. So we're going to get through this season, and then staff's going to come back with perhaps some pricing amendments based on who is here and when.
Okay, well, we've got, of course, the test, I guess the real test, coming up during Sundance. Is anything going to be done differently then?
Well, it actually leads into an item that comes up later in the agenda, which is staff is highlighting they are increasing the parking rate, the daily rate in the China Bridge parking structure for Sundance. And in past years, it had been around $25, and this year staff is recommending that it go up to $40. The reason that we're doing that is because we have a parking problem. We have a congestion problem. We're trying to create a deterrent for people to bring in their cars. And so the message here is ride transit, carpool, rideshare, do these other things to get in and out of the city, because if you do come in, it is going to be expensive to park when we are the most congested.
Yeah. Part of the problem was just the getting out of the garage and then just the traffic buildup between here and Kearns Boulevard. Have we figured out how we're going to get those buses through?
Well, we're working on it, and I think for instance, one of the things that we're going to be discussing tomorrow evening is letting people pay up front during the festival. We are concerned with the congestion that it may create, having to, you know, grab a ticket on your way into the garage. And so we are going to allow people to pay up front. We're going to have parking attendants there. And one of the reasons that we're doing that is to ensure that we reduce congestion as much as possible at sort of the entry and exit ways of these park structures.
Yeah, but that's just the parking. Are we doing anything with just the transit itself, like dedicated bus lines again, or closing Bonanza to vehicles so that the buses can get through and...
All good questions. Maybe not that drastic, but we are using shoulders. You will see us using shoulders on 224. I think I recall you asking that question of Tom Fisher yesterday. So we are going to be doing everything and anything, all hands on deck. This is an incredibly busy time for our staff as well as our community. We're going to need everyone's help. It's not going to get better if we all continue to drive in and out of here on our own. And we need to tell our guests and our friends, our employees, our colleagues, our coworkers, our family to help us in that effort. And I'll just say from the city's perspective, we're doing everything we can. We have some incentive programs for our own employees. We're incentivizing carpooling and taking transit and rideshare and trying to do our part and sort of walking the walk as well.
Okay. Real quick, still no information with regard to the Treasure Hill discussion. Do you have any updated information that people can come and comment about?
We will be producing some information today before the meeting. We hope to have a staff report out that has some very, very specific information about the size of the hotel, about gross and net square footages of the hotel, potentially where the hotel would be sited up on the hillside, and then some additional information about the single families, about how big they might be and what their kind of gross and net square footage might be. I know this has been a difficult process for the public, and we've asked people to sort of give us the benefit of the doubt and trust us here, and tonight should be a big evening. I think that, you know, for the first time, we're going to hopefully demonstrate some specificity to the plans in terms of the 50% reduction. And then we're going to have about a week or two for the community and the planning commissioners to really dig into it. I mean, obviously, we wish that we could have had this out and to the community sooner. But, you know, all hands are on deck. We're doing everything that we can. We had employees working over the holidays, and there's been a very, very compressed time period. The applicant has been very cooperative. We really enjoyed working with the applicant. We think that they are cooperating, and they also want to see this come to completion in a positive manner, but we still have got our work cut out for us.
Yeah, so what's the rush now at this point? Because we have until August to decide, the City Council does, and whether or not to put a bond, $24 million bond, on November's ballot. So why are we rushing?
Well, I don't know if we're rushing so much as we've got sort of hopefully a willing buyer and a willing seller, and the two entities that actually own the property up there have given us this period to work within. That would be to their discretion if they were going to allow us to extend the deadlines that we've set. The deadlines were negotiated, obviously, between the mayor and the applicants, and so we are doing the best that we can within the deadlines that we have. That would be, you know, up for a renegotiation if we were to get the deadlines extended.
Right. And I guess given the impact of Sundance on the city staff, it just seems really unfair to have to, like, kind of drop. Well, you can't drop Sundance. So it's,
I
don't know. So it's in their benefit, though, it seems to me, to have this decision rushed because we really don't know what we're getting into because we haven't had time to analyze it.
Well, I mean, perhaps that's one point of view. However, we've, you know, spent 30 years looking at this project and having our technicians from planners to engineers to grade experts, excavation experts, real estate agents look at this project. So on the one hand, it is all hands on deck and we are in a compressed time frame. On the other hand, we've had some experts in the city dealing with the Treasure Hill project and all of its nuances for decades. And so that's a good part. We really weren't starting from scratch. We've got obviously the last 24 months of the planning commissioners and their planning process alone that have informed what we've been doing in the last few weeks. And so that's benefited us greatly. And I think that the planning commissioners supported initially a compressed time frame. They put blood, sweat, tears, and effort, and they were close to getting to a vote. And I think that if they thought that they were going to pause the process, that they weren't going to pause it too long, and we thought that was fair.
Okay, I need to leave it there. Matt, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
At 8:45, good morning. Well, the Sundance Film Festival, bigger than just Park City, in addition to all of the permitting that must be approved by the municipality, Summit County Health Department is also very involved. In the studio with more, I have the Health Department's Director of Environmental Health, Phil Bondurant. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Leslie.
So what is the Health Department's role in the Sundance Film Festival?
Much like the Park City Building Department, the Health Department has a role of protecting the safety and sanitation of the residents as well as the venues that take place. So much like a traditional restaurant, brick and mortar, there's a responsibility to ensure the food that's served at these venues is compliant with state and federal regulations and that we're securing a high level of sanitation and food safety at each of these events, including where drinks are served as well. That falls into the realm of the FDA food code just like it would in any other bar in Park City.
Right. So all these people that are serving food, I mean, would all have to have food handlers permits? Do you check on stuff like that?
So the way the temporary events are set up, and that's what this is considered as a temporary event, is that there needs to be one individual, typically a manager or supervisor, that has that food handler's card or ServSafe certification. In a temporary event, there's the expectation that they'll be supervising and overseeing the operations. So not like a traditional restaurant where everybody has to have one. We just see a few of them in there. So we do go through and check to make sure that that's done. That's part of the early permitting process that we're really promoting this year, is to get in early, get those permits applied for so that we can make sure that each of these venues are successful and that the interaction with the health department is only as minimal as needed.
Yeah. I mean, what time does it take from your staff to ensure the safety of these venues?
Well, we're not as involved as the building department is, where we have people running 24/7. We do have staff on call, and we will be out on Friday and Saturday night and a good portion of Sunday doing inspections at venues. Typically, Friday and Saturday night are our later nights. We're out until the wee hours of the morning with the building department, going through finding those venues that are unpermitted that need a permit, and making sure that they have what they need to be successful in getting those permits. And then in some cases, if warranted, we will close down facilities for lack of compliance and sanitation.
Yeah, so I mean, I've got the city council agenda in front of me with all of the approvals for permitting, and we're talking about 4.5 pages, singles, maybe double, 1.5 spaces between each of these different venues that you've got to go
right
check out, huh?
Yeah, and it's really important to acknowledge the Park City Building Department and Park City Emergency Management in Hugh, because they have done a great job in involving the health department in these venues so that we see the same list that they do, and that we are supplied with the same radio channel that Park City Emergency Management and Park City Building Department is on, so that we can be alerted just as quickly as they are. And when they call and say we need to meet at this venue or this event, we can meet there and have staff on site so that we can make sure that both organizations are on the same page in dealing with these events.
Okay, so you've got some upcoming deadlines for permitting. What are those?
As of December 12th at 5 o'clock, All permits regarding any food service or drink service need to be submitted to the health department.
January 12th.
January 12th, yep, excuse me. And the reason for that is it allows us to get a full list of what we are expecting as inspectors, but also provide each of these permit holders with the right information that they need to be successful. So if they come on board and they start showing up next week, we can send inspectors out preemptively to say, okay, we need to make sure you have the following items so that you can be successful during your inspection in the upcoming Sundance event.
Right. So the 12th is Friday, and that really only gives you like 3-4 days to get that work done, but you will be working weekends, it sounds like.
Right. And we have roughly right now about 55 permits that have already been submitted and approved. So we've got the bulk of what we believe our involvement will be completed, but we always find a few latecomers that we would like to make sure that they understand that the health department is here as a partner to help them through this event, and would much rather work with them in a partnership than a regulatory role.
So who has to seek the permit? Is it the property owner or is it the lessee?
It should be whoever is coming in and providing that food for the venue. We see that where space is rented out, and so if an company is coming in and renting out space from the brick and mortar leaseholder, then they need to come in and get a permit. There's not a transition where an existing food permit in an establishment carries over to a new venue, because it's new staff, new food preparation, new events going on inside. So we need to make sure that while we know our brick and mortars are good and compliant, the new staff coming in or the new people coming in from out of state are compliant as well.
Yeah. Are we aware of any health issues as, in previous festivals?
Nothing that's an event that would, constitute a public health emergency, but that's the reason we're out there, is we want to make sure that we don't get to that level. We've seen some of the recent articles from down in Salt Lake and how quickly hepatitis A and these type of things can spread from food handlers, and that's the main focus of the Environmental Health Department, is to get out and do these inspections so that that tag is not associated with Sundance Film Festival moving forward. You know, our colleagues in Salt Lake and Utah County are fully fledged in this right now down there, and we don't want a similar instance up here. And so while we don't conduct testing for hepatitis A with the food handlers, there is a way that if we are making sure that food safety and sanitation regulations are being followed, that we can minimize that potential or that possibility from some type of outbreak, whether it be a norovirus or hepatitis A or any other type of foodborne illness sweeping through Sundance and really putting a damper on the event as a whole.
Yeah. How is Hep A transmitted?
It's transmitted from person to person through food handling and that sort of thing. And it's one of the bigger, the bigger concerns that you could have in the food industry.
Yeah. I mean, is it a result of not washing hands, after using the restroom or
Yeah, that,
like that?
Bloodborne as well. And so you look at these events where we have food handlers that are potentially cutting lemons and limes for drinks, and they nick their finger and they're not washing their hands, they don't have gloves on. You start to look at how easily something like that could happen. And so that's important for us to be out making sure that we have hand washing stations available, that gloves are being used, that fruits are being washed and ready to eat foods are being handled appropriately.
I think there's a vaccine for it too, isn't there?
There is.
Okay. All right, Phil, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I appreciate the opportunity to come on, and hopefully those that are listening, if you have a Sundance event coming into your venue, please contact the health department. Amy Jones is our administrative assistant who handles that, and she'd be more than willing to help.
Okay, just the basic phone number?
Yep, 435-333-1500.
Okay. So, Phil, hey, thanks for your time this morning.
Yep, you bet.
That's Summit County Health Department Environmental Health Director Phil Bondurant. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Joining me now on the phone with an update of what's going on in the Wasatch County School District, I have the Superintendent of Schools, Paul Sweat. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing well, thanks. Hey, real quick, just wanted to ask, with the start of the Utah legislature starting in another week or so, any issues that the Wasatch County School District following, or is it just basic education funding?
Well, I think something that we need to be aware of in our area, along with Wasatch and Summit County, is, there continues to be a push for equalization at the legislature and equalization of funds throughout the state. So there's a there's a perception and certainly some reality to the fact that some school districts are funded better than others because of their assessed valuation inside that county. And and there continues to be a push for more equalization, and I think that in our county as well as in Summit County, we need to watch this carefully and make sure that we have proper input on any legislation that is passed along those lines.
Yeah. You have a pretty good relationship with the district representatives?
Yes. Very good. And I, you know, to explain equalization a little bit for some, I think that we have to be careful in pushing this equalization thing too far. It's a very complex formula as far as how we fund our schools in Utah, and the truth is Utah is ranked number one by Education Week magazine for already being equalized. The basic FTE that comes out from the state is 100% equalized. That's gathered property taxes statewide and then issued on a very equal basis throughout the state. And there's a couple of other levies that are equalized as well, but there still is those local levies that we draw from that certainly counties like Wasatch and Summit have higher assessed valuation and we draw in more taxes in that area. But I think if I could make a point this morning for our listeners. When folks at the legislature tend to talk about equalization, they only look at the revenue side, and there's always a push to equalize revenue. What they need to do a better job of considering is the cost side as well. So not only do we have higher assessed valuation up here, but that means it's harder for people to live and work in our district in the education system. Teachers have a hard time buying homes in our counties, and so I don't think it's fair for us to just consider the revenue side. We have to consider the cost side. It's more expensive for us to run a school district in our counties versus in some of the more rural counties. And then the other thing that we need to look at is economy of scale. Some of the large districts may not have a huge assessed valuation, but when you have a district with 75,000 or 50,000 students in it, I don't think it's fair to compare student by student the valuation comparison, because if you have 70,000 students, there's lots of things you can do and offer because of that economy of scale. So just for example, I don't think it's a real fair way to look at it to take money from a smaller district that has a whole different expense preview than a large and give that to a large district that already has one of everything that they need to run their services. So yeah. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, we don't have much time here, so let's just talk briefly about the growth you've seen in the Wasatch School District. Of course, you've seen hundreds, if not 1,000 units recently built on what is probably known as Park City South, the Black Rock Ridge area. What's that done to your district, maybe to your transportation costs specifically?
Well, it's definitely I don't know that I want to say burden, but it's a burden on our finances for sure, and we continue to try and navigate through this growth, and Wasatch County was recently listed as the fastest growing county in the state, and the state is one of the fastest growing states in the union, and so it's important for us to stay in front of it, on top of it, more long range planning, working more closely with our planners and developers here in the valley, and it's a concern, and it's one that we're taking very seriously, and we just opened two new schools, and if we weren't right now looking at what the next school is going to look like and be, we'd be negligent if we weren't considering that as we speak.
Yeah, because of the close proximity to Park City, I've heard from people say we should look at consolidating school districts. Would that ever happen?
I don't ever see it happening. I think there's a long-standing tradition and culture of local control and local school district, and you get outside of our states and some of the you get out into an Iowa or an Idaho, or and it's even more pronounced. We have 40 school districts in the state of Utah, and it's common for some states to have hundreds and hundreds of school districts. I think that you know, I think folks like having the local school board in a smaller setting rather than a large setting. I would never really envision consolidation. No.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm out of time. I hope next time we can spend more time with you. But thanks for your time this morning, Paul.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.